Hello.
This is Lori and Tori coming to you from the haunted corners of New England, and you're listening to the Something Wicked podcast, the show that delves deep into the topics of true crime, haunted histories, and all things paranormal. Dedicated to those that love to know all the spoopy and gruesome details on psycho serial killers, ghastly ghouls, and creepy cryptids with tales to make you sleep with the lights on. We are back with part three of the infamous West Memphis 3 case. In part one, we covered the basics, the crime, the trial, and the aftermath. And in part two, we cover the timelines and witness statements regarding the disappearances of the three boys. So if you haven't listened to those, I recommend you go back and check them out. On today's episode, we are going to cover the theories and who we think committed this horrific crime. There aren't nearly as many theories for this case as some of our others that we covered. I'm looking at you, Dietloff.
Seriously?
That shit was insane.
But what we found is shocking, and in my opinion, just proves further just how much of a targeted, bungled case this is.
Oh, yeah.
So buckle up, kids, and let's get it. Hello and welcome back to the show, and for those of you new to the podcast, I'll say thanks for tuning in. As we said in the intro, we are on part three of the West Memphis 3 case, where we are going to deep dive into the whodunit aspect of this crime. I, for one, stick by my opinion on who I think did it, and although there is a lot of speculation, there is a lot of damning evidence and witness statements that I will present that will back up my reasoning for pointing the finger. Again, if I'm ever proven wrong in the future, I'll own up to it fully, but until then, I will die on this hill.
Oh, damn.
I will leave a question in the show notes as to what your opinion is on the case, and after hearing all of the evidence, who you think committed it. And as always, if any of my lovelies have any information to help authorities, we will leave the number for the tip line in the show notes as well to help bring justice to Stevie, Michael, and Christopher. And here we go.
Whee!
So before we start any of these shenanigans, I have to ask, who do you think did it, Chica, based on everything so far?
So I don't really know, but I'm kind of leaning towards John Byers because he's very suspicious. Every single interview we saw with him, he just seems so goddamn suspicious. But maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
No, I can agree with you in some aspect, but there will be things here with the theories that go into seemingly backing you up on that. It does sound suspicious as hell.
Or there's those random kids that came out of the woods too, you know, like
they, yeah,
or the guy at the, what was the restaurant,
Bojangles.
Mr. Bojangles, because he's also suspicious as fuck and nobody looked into him.
Yeah,
so I don't know, there's too many different directions for me to be like, oh, it's probably,
yeah,
this
that's
person.
Why this is so nuts and it's driving me crazy.
Yeah, seriously.
So for the theories, let's start with Brian Holland and Chris Morgan. On May 15th, 16th, and 17th of 1993, police in Oceanside, California interrogated Chris Morgan, age 19, and Brian Holland, age 20, two Memphis residents who have driven from Tennessee to California a few days after the murders. Huh. Both Morgan and Holland repeatedly denied any involvement in or direct knowledge about the killings. Both failed polygraphs. Christopher Morgan later testified at the Baldwin Eccles trial with the jury absent that his interrogation lasted 17 hours over two sessions.
Jesus Christ.
That the Oceanside police never read him his rights and that they kept him locked up even though he was supposedly not in custody.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
During his post-polygraph interview, after 13 plus hours of questioning, Christopher Morgan got angry and said, "What do you want me to do? Lie to you? I'm gonna lie to you. I'm gonna lie. I killed them and all that other bullshit. I don't know how I did it." Immediately afterward, according to Morgan, he said, "I may have told them that. Are you happy?" And the detective said, "Is that the truth?" And I said, "No." Later, Morgan said, "Well, maybe I freaked out, then blacked out and killed the three little boys and fucked them up the ass or something." He asked for a hypnotist to check his blackout possibility, but insisted, "I've never hurt anyone intentionally." So I don't know about that. It's like, it seems suspicious because they just kind of fucked off to California.
But that could have been completely unrelated.
Yeah, but also if you're being locked up in a room by the police, 17 hours of interrogation.
Yeah, dude, I'd say fucking whatever.
And say you're just a witness.
But I'd be like, you guys are assholes, so fuck you.
It's again going back to Miss Kelly, where it's just like, I just want to go home. I just want to get the fuck out of here. So I'm going to say whatever the hell you want me to say.
You think I did it? Fine. Yeah. Can I go to fucking bed? Like, I need a goddamn nap or a coffee. Yeah. Either way, y'all need to get the fuck out of my face.
California police sent blood and urine samples from Morgan and Holland to the WMPD, but there is no indication that the WMPD investigated Morgan or Holland as suspects following their arrests in California. The relevance of Morgan's recanted statement would later be debated in trial, but was eventually barred from admission as evidence. So there was a full 17-hour interrogation that had been done on Chris, and it was thrown out because Chris had covered up the camera before he said, "I might have done it," because the court said it didn't count because they couldn't see him making the statement.
What?
So they weren't sure if that was an actual admission of guilt. I mean, yeah, he didn't actually say he did it. He told them he was going to lie before he said he might have. But the court acknowledged that this was Morgan's interview tape. And if it's okay to accept audio recordings of an interview, why is it all of a sudden not acceptable for an audio clip from a covered video? Completely besides the fact that he knew the boys. He drove the ice cream truck around the neighborhood and sold ice cream to them. He had a long history of drug use, charges, and blackouts. Ugh. And Pamela Hobbs, Stevie's mom, recalled him coming over to visit her home after the murders and ask for Stevie's picture, because that's not suspicious.
That's just creepy.
Mind you, he said he visited to show remorse. He specifically said remorse that the boys had been killed.
Huh.
Yeah, he did.
Okay.
Because the cops were like, "Why did you go over there?" He's like, "Oh, I wanted to show remorse." He's like, "Remorse?" He's like, "Yeah." So I don't know if he
just doesn't know the exact meaning of
the
word.
He meant to say condolences or, you know, something like that instead of remorse.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, with the type of people that we've seen in this case, I wouldn't be surprised if he just got the fucking word wrong.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't be shocked either. But it's just, it's really still suspicious that he chose that word, remorse.
Right.
Now on to Mr. Bojangles.
Mr. Bojangles.
To start this one, we need to go back to Aaron Hutchinson. He had stated to police that he had seen Michael Moore talking to a tall, skinny black man outside of school on May 5th, that this guy was trying to get him into his car to give him a ride home. So maybe when Michael said no, this man followed him home, and when Michael went to play with the other two boys, the man followed them and killed them. At least according to this theory. And Aaron's description of the man matched the man who is now dubbed Mr. Bojangles. On the night of May 5th, 1993, as parents and police were searching for the missing boys, a strange event occurred at a nearby fast food restaurant called Bojangles. A black man, apparently dazed and covered in blood and mud, had staggered into the restaurant. He went into the ladies' room, where he stayed the better part of an hour as the evening shift workers prepared to close down for the night. The restaurant manager, Marty King, recalled that the man had blood on his face and blood dripping from his forearm and generally was disarrayed. And he was wearing a blue nylon jogging suit and a cast on one arm. He also had thick mud caked on his shoes. Quote, like he'd been through a field, King said. Water was soaked into his pants up to his knees.
Hmm.
Mm. King grew concerned as the man stayed in the restroom about 30 to 45 minutes. At one point, King poked his head in the door. Excrement covered the floor, and it was on the man, too. The man, propping himself up, had also smeared blood on the walls.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. The bloody dazed man arrived at Bojangles sometime between 8 and 9:30 p.m. Bojangles was about 1 mile from the woods where the boys were last seen and where their bodies were found the next day.
Hmm.
Officer Regina Meek responded to the Bojangles call, spoke to a restaurant employee at the drive-thru window.
What?
Searched the area for the bloody man, then left. The next night, May 6th, detectives Allen and Ridge visited Bojangles, talked to Marty King, and took blood scrapings from the bathroom. The bloody man had left sunglasses in the toilet, but the detectives didn't bother taking him. That's at least that's what the police say. But then King said that he offered them. He said that the dude left these sunglasses in the toilet, and the police were like, "Nah."
Ugh.
And then the police claimed that they never took them, and that the manager must have thrown them away or something.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Ridge later testified that he put the Bojangles blood sample in his desk, never sent it to the crime lab, forgot about it, and eventually lost it.
Oh my god.
Yeah, and Marty King testified that he was never approached by police again regarding the incident. Okay, I have to interject here. Why in the God's names did the first responding officer go through the drive-thru?
Right, did you even bother getting out of your car?
Was that
at
the
all?
Standard practice in their department? I mean, come on. We're searching for three missing boys in the area, so this strange-acting, blood-covered man with mud all over can't be important, right? Jesus.
I mean, maybe she was scared.
Then the WMPD didn't even try to investigate or recover any evidence until the next day, and that was only after the second call from the restaurant was made. Then they misplaced those blood samples. Wow. To top it all off, they had the nerve to accuse the employees and blame them for contaminating evidence because they tried to clean up after the first officer left. Oh my god, I'm sorry. I just can't believe people can be that stupid.
Yeah, really.
And the man matched Aaron's description. I know that Aaron's statement overall was extremely coached, but if the police took it as damn near gospel at the time, you'd think they would be a little more vigilant in going after this lead.
Yeah, really. Especially a guy covered in fucking mud and blood. You know, like, come on.
Mm-hmm. So, was Mr. Bojangles involved in the murders of the children? Perhaps the most salient facts about him were that even though he was bleeding and disoriented, he did not seek assistance.
Right.
He did not come forward later to explain his actions in spite of his notoriety. It appears as though he was avoiding authorities. Perhaps his injuries were related to criminal activity, and perhaps he had an active warrant for his arrest.
Or maybe it doesn't have to do with these kids, but he definitely fucking killed someone.
Or something happened to him.
Something happened, and this is just overlooked entirely. Like, yeah. He's either a victim or a fucking criminal. Either way, do something.
Yeah. It is rightly pointed out that Mr. Bojangles could not have likely been a sole perpetrator or could have walked all the way bleeding and disoriented from the Blue Beacon area without leaving more of a trail of blood. This consideration has the Blue Beacon Woods as the site of the murders. Perhaps the murders took place in a location nearer to the Bojangles restaurant.
I mean, yeah.
Perhaps Bojangles had a falling out and fight with other perpetrators. Or, quite possibly, this event was anomalous and had nothing to do with the murders. All right. Of this remains a speculation, as the mystery of Bojangles has never been solved. That's what I mean. They just did the little that they did and were just like, nah.
That was
it's no effort. Yeah.
None.
The murder of Stephanie Crow in Escondido, California has a number of eerie similarities with the West Memphis murders. In this case, the teenage brother confessed and implicated two of his teenage friends. The occult was blamed. In the Crow case, however, the police kept an evidence sample from a local disoriented transient, a bloody piece of clothing, and just before the trial of the teenagers, the blood was matched to the victim's DNA. The transient has since been convicted of the murders. Because of the lost Bojangles evidence, this can never be done for the West Memphis murders.
Ugh.
So it's what's fucked up is that it's similar. Like, yeah. The whole case is similar, and the fact that it was this bloody disoriented man that got matched. Who's to say?
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't him. Like, if he just, like Chris Morgan, fucked off to California and went off and did another crime.
Oh my god.
Or some shit. I'm not saying he did it. It's just, it's so fucking warped.
Just the fact that nothing was fucking done. And yeah. Then they lost whatever evidence they did get.
Oh my god.
Can you drop the ball any fucking harder? You spiked that bitch into the ground.
Yeah! On to Ed Edwards. No, that was not a stutter. His name is actually Edward Edwards.
Oh my god.
This theory is posited by retired detective John Cameron. He's written two books on this. In them, John states that Ed was the most prolific serial killer you've never heard of. This is funny because I, should have covered him when I first started the show, if right? That's the case. He puts him at the scene of all these notorious murders, such as JonBenet Ramsey, Elizabeth Short, so the Black Dahlia, the West Memphis Three, the Lacey Peterson murder, the Zodiac Killer, and more.
Wait, like, what?
Yeah.
So he's blaming this person for everything ever?
Yeah, and immoral, apparently, because the Black Dahlia murder happened back in 1947 and Lacey was in 2002. But anyway.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? The fucking world we live in, we might have immortal serial killers.
He was a serial killer that wanted to be famous, known to kill two couples and a son for the insurance money, but one, he wasn't as active as John claims, and two, because of his hunger for fame, he would have been stupid enough to announce his crimes to the world, not stay hidden like the Zodiac or the West Memphis killers.
Right.
If you were really that hungry and starved to get that 15 minutes of fame.
I'm turning myself in. Guess what, bitch? I killed three kids.
Especially, no, even just the Zodiac.
Yeah,
even true. If that he was him, he would not hide. He would not wear that weird-ass suit. He wouldn't send the puzzles to the newspapers.
Yeah.
That he did. He'd be like, I did it, it's me, and then just show up at a fucking police station.
Yeah.
There's no point in it. So I don't know where the hell this detective is getting his theories from, yeah, really. But, you know, it
must
whatever.
Just be some sort of vendetta against this guy.
Vendetta, vendetta. Sorry, I had to. Oh my God. Moving on to John Mark Byers.
Yep.
This is one of the most popular theories. This one and the last, Terry Hobbs, will be the rest of the episode because they have the majority of information I found on both of them.
And they're both fucking sketch as hell. Yep. No matter what. Mm-hmm. No matter what fucking interview you watch with either of these people, they just seem so suspicious.
Yeah, the messed up thing, though, is that John Byers is dead now.
Oh, yeah. So, I forgot about that.
Terry, however, I don't know what the fuck's going on with him, but oh, God. In November 1993, John Mark Byers was interrogated by WMPD officers after he had given a knife to a member of a film crew who were making a documentary about the case. During questioning by the police, John admitted that he had given the knife away. He also stated that his wife, Melissa, had given it to him for Christmas 2 or 3 years previously, and he had never used it. He kept it in the top drawer of a dresser in his bedroom, where he was sure that neither of the boys could have gained access to it. When asked whether anyone might have cut themselves with a knife, Byers stated that he was certain that no one had. The story changed when the interviewing officer told him that the blood had been found on the knife. Byers then recalled that he had used the knife to cut up some deer meat at home. When he was told that the blood found on the knife had matched Christopher's blood type, Byers continued to assert that he had no idea how Christopher's blood had come to be there. Later, after test results on Melissa, Ryan, and John Byers were concluded, it was found that the bloodstains matched in blood type with both John and Christopher Byers. No further testing was carried out, which could have determined more conclusively whether it was Christopher or John Byers' blood. Another item of evidence which could have linked John Mark Byers to the murders, at least as much as any evidence brought against Damien, Jason, and Jesse, was the presence of another human hair on the victim's clothing. It was a black Caucasian hair, which was shown to be microscopically similar to both John Mark Byers and Damien Eccles. Unfortunately, nothing more specific was determined, but John is a blonde? What? And where the hell did this come into play? I never heard of a black-colored hair being found. I'm going off of theory websites where I'm getting this from, so I'm not sure where this person got that information. I know of a hair police said was from a black person on the sheet from one of the boys' bodies. I don't know. I'm slightly confused.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this shit doesn't really make much sense.
Yeah, because it's what I mean. The first and foremost, even if that was a piece of information that I missed, it's John is blonde.
Yeah.
He's never dyed his hair or anything that I know of, so how could it match to John? I don't know. During this interrogation, the interviewing officer asked Byers what medication he was on, to which he answered Xanax and Zurinol, which he stated were antidepressants. When he was asked whether he had any other medications, he told police no, yet he had stated at other times that he was taking Tegretol, which is the brand name of the drug carbamazepine. This is the same substance which was found in non-therapeutic amounts in Christopher's blood after his death. Christopher had also been taking Tegretol, according to his medical records, but Byers had stated that Chris had not taken his medication on the day that he went missing. Why would he have that in his blood, then?
Mm.
There's also the issue of him getting all his teeth removed shortly after the murders were committed. He stated to the documentary crew that he had to get them taken out due to a disease. I personally feel it's because of all the drug use, but anyway. It's just suspicious because when the evidence is presented about the bite marks, he gets dentures.
Yeah.
Also, a few years after the first Paradise Lost documentary was released, John's wife, Melissa, randomly died of unknown causes. She just showed up at the hospital, died, and the doctors were never able to figure out the cause.
What the fuck?
There's a lot of poisons that can do that, though.
Yeah, there are.
Oh, so God. It's, yeah. And I understand that there are some cases that people legitimately die natural deaths and the doctors are not able to figure it out. It's just in a case that's tied to somebody like that, it's like, that doesn't seem natural.
Yeah. It's like every direction you just seem more and more fucking suspicious, especially when people keep dying around you.
Yeah. As far as his alibi, he gives extensive statements to the police of every move he made that day up until 4:30 a.m. on May 6th, that he was out searching the entire time. I'm not saying he didn't, but there are several reasons why the alibi of John is anemic. First, there are a number of people that he specifically describes being with at key times who give statements recalling the events that don't include him. These include Clint Garner, Clint Garner's mother, Ryan Clark, Britt Smith, Robbie Young, and Richie Masters. And then there are those never identified. The two black men at the Blue Beacon, the black girl and boy on the 14th, the police officer at the Big Star, and there are those who either weren't interviewed or else were interviewed, and their statements regarding their interactions with John Byers that night didn't appear in the West Memphis Police Department documents. Those include Dana Moore, Terry Hobbs, Jackie Hicks, Captain Ball, and Tony Hudson.
I'm sorry, Captain Ball?
Yeah. Again with these fucking names.
Captain Ball. Sound like a wannabe superhero.
Like Captain Hammer?
Captain Planet. He's a hero. Right,
and finally, there are those that were interviewed or testified that in parts didn't prove much clarity on John Mark Byers' whereabouts. These include Melissa Byers and Ryan Clark. There are different levels of corroboration or contradiction. Multiple corroboration is when multiple witnesses have provided statements that are in agreement. This isn't always possible because sometimes there are not multiple witnesses. Single corroboration is when at least a single witness corroborates and no witness contradicts. Potential corroboration is when a witness gives a statement that may confirm a purported event, but the discrepancies are such that it may be referring to another event. No corroboration is where there is no statement that confirms or denies. Negative corroboration is when statements exist that should corroborate, but the corroboration is noticeably absent. Potential contradiction is when the statement that could corroborate has a seeming contradiction. Contradiction is when the statement that could corroborate contradicts. I feel like I'm reading either fucking Lewis Carroll or Dr. Seuss at this point. Jesus fuck. The following is the time breakdown of his alibi, whether corroborated or not. 3:30 to 6:30 p.m., corroborated by one or more of the following: Ryan Clark, Melissa Byers, Christine Roberts. 6:30 to 8 p.m., the general event of driving around the area is corroborated by Ryan Clark and Melissa Byers. The event encountering a police officer is corroborated by Ryan Clark and Melissa Byers, but not the police officer. Yeah. The event of meeting with the Garners has negative corroboration.
Sorry, just the terminology here is great.
Sighting by Jimmy Sellers, not corroborated. 8 to 8:30 p.m., meeting with Officer Regina Meek has multiple corroboration from all parties involved, which...
seems like the only real solid piece there.
But Meek is the one that reported to the Bojangles restaurant.
Is it?
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Huh.
She was at the drive-thru.
The fucking drive.
Yeah, I still can't believe that's the most retarded ass shit ever. 8:30 to 9:30 p.m.
I'm sorry, but you do not conduct any sort of police investigation.
What time did he arrive? Can I also get a number three?
You want fries with that?
Oh my God.
It was more like four.
8:30 to 9:30 p.m.
Oh my
no
God.
Corroboration for meeting with black children on 14th Street. Wow. No corroboration for meeting with Dana Moore and Terry Hobbs and going to Woods with them. Negative corroboration from multiple sources for going with Ryan Clark, Robbie Young, Britt Smith, and Richie Masters to the woods. Although Melissa Byers mentions that John Byers and Ryan went to the woods with her, and she said she didn't go in. 9:45 to 10:15 p.m. Corroboration for searching area with John Moore. 10:15 to midnight. Negative corroboration / contradiction for searching Blue Beacon area with Ryan Clark. No corroboration for contacting Regina Meek. Well, no shit, because she was out searching for Mr. Bojangles. Midnight. Potential corroboration for midnight meeting with other victims' families. No corroboration for searching the woods with these family members. So everything is just like, he's not getting corroborated for anything. And if it is, it's contradicted by another fucking party.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Midnight to 2 a.m. No corroboration for meeting with Officer Ball. No corroboration for going with Tony Hudson and Melissa to Mid-Continent Building.
I thought it was Captain Ball. Is that actually the, like, police captain? Is that...
I don't know.
Huh. I'm sorry, but I won't forget Captain Ball.
Again, going off of these things.
Like, I know.
This is shit I'm pulling from... I don't know. These people confuse me. I don't like... Tori, help me.
I'm trying. I can't even keep track at this point.
2 to 3 a.m. Corroboration by Melissa Byers as to ending search. Contradiction with earlier statement that he searched until 4:30 a.m. And 3 to 6 a.m. No corroboration, possible contradiction.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he was doing a whole lot of fucking nothing.
Yeah. That's what I mean.
It's like it's, everybody's like, we were going around to these places. And you know, like, I don't know if John was there.
It's six one way, half a dozen the other.
Yeah.
Because it's all these people are saying that he did these things. And then other people are like, no, he was with me. And then the third party is like, no, they weren't with him. They were with me. It's like, well, what? What? Who were you with? Were you just, did you find a spot in the woods and just stood there? And it's like, I'm totally searching for them.
He just sat behind a tree and like, they'll find him eventually.
I did a 360 and I couldn't find him. Now I'm gonna sit here. What the fuck?
Hope the dogs don't find me.
Oh my god. The evidence itself surrounding the boys is possibly damning to him as well. The most telling piece of evidence are the old scars on his stepson's body, the victim, Chris Byers. The medical examiner specified 3 scars, 2 on his face and 1 on his chest, and a few more on his lower extremities. From the perspective of a social worker, if a client says that his child's scar was caused by an accident, this is believable for a single scar. If the child has 2 scars, you get the story, the kid is accident prone, and there should be an investigation. 3, and the child should be removed from the family during the investigation. How many scars did Chris Byers have? 3 specified a few, more suggests a minimum of 6. In this instance, the child not only had the scars, but the child also ended up murdered.
Yeah.
In cases of child abuse, the parents will say, oh, that scar, he fell down the stairs. For multiple scars, such as statements assume stupidity or incompetence on the part of the social worker, like the declaration that the initials of John Mark Byers Supremacist Group, GFBD, meant going fishing with Bill Deal. Or like assertions in earlier days that such white supremacist groups are civic organizations. And there are Byers' various claims that his dark past was before his son's murder, or after his son's murder when he fell apart and then he became reformed. Or he's been clean since prison. Even though he continues to threaten people using the name in his association with a violent white supremacy group. This is simple sociopathy. But does it prove he's a murderer? The medical examiner stated at trial the time of his death was between 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. For this time period, John has virtually no corroborated alibi. The closest corroboration during this period is Melissa Byers saying they finished searching at 2 to 3 a.m. John, however, negated this by saying he searched until 4:30 a.m. and in the same sentence declared he walked within 10 or 15 feet of where the bodies were found.
I don't know if it means that you're a murderer, but it definitely means you're suspicious as fuck.
Yeah, did John have time to commit the murders? Yes. It is simple to construct a scenario consistent with his alibi and the evidence that provides opportunity for the murders. Although not corroborated, he said he encountered Lieutenant...
Now it's Lieutenant Ball. Jesus Christ. Pick one. Officer, Captain, Lieutenant.
Yeah.
Which one? It's all in one day, too, so it's not like this motherfucker got a promotion.
I don't know. I don't know. Again, this is shit. You know, sometimes, folks, when I take these notes, there's so much, and I miss little shit, like titles and things like that. I did not, for one, say captain, then officer, then lieutenant. I don't know where the fuck. It's either three different people that all have the last name Ball.
They all work in the police force.
Oh my
all
god.
In the same precinct.
I'm just gonna say officer. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, at least that's the safest bet.
Although not corroborated, he said he encountered Officer Ball at about 1:30, quarter till 2, according to Byers. The officer went on to say maybe they have found an abandoned house or a shed in somebody's backyard or a building they've got up in that building. And the building they've got up in that building, you know, for cover. Well, where is Byers getting this? A building inside a building.
Oh, these are the fucking people. She mad about it, yo.
This is a quote. Mind you, this is not the notes from the article. This is a quote he's saying.
Oh, no.
Somebody's backyard or a building and they've got up in that building, you know, for cover. Because the mosquitoes, it was warm that night and mosquitoes were kind of bad. So when he said that, I thought of an abandoned house down the street from me. So I went and looked in that.
What?
First, you were within 15 feet of where the bodies were found. Now you're in a building inside of a building. That's an abandoned house that has mosquitoes.
No, they went into the abandoned house to avoid the mosquitoes.
Oh, that's right. Oh, Jesus, fuck. Oh my god, this dude. Ugh. Perhaps Byers encountered the children in an abandoned house and, furious at Chris, killed him. He killed the other two because they were witnesses. At a time approaching 4:30 a.m. when there is no record of anyone else looking, he took the bodies and bicycles up to the back of the Blue Beacon. There are no interviews with Blue Beacon employees concerning the night after midnight hours. Why not?
But, yeah, first of all, another fucking ball dropped. But also, like, why would Byers bring the kids over there when there was just people searching?
Yeah.
He wouldn't have the knowledge of people being done. You would have to scope out that area first, which you could do during
the
search.
That's the other thing.
But
if they were supposedly killed, the doctor saying, testifying that Chris, at least, not the other two, but just Chris, was murdered anytime between 1:30 and 7 a.m.
Yeah.
But people were out all night searching.
Right.
And in that area, how were they killed in that area between 1 and 7:30 if people were
out
there,
yeah,
searching?
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Oh my god. So, did this scenario happen? Probably not. It's also simple to construct a dozen other scenarios. These opportunities multiply if an accomplice is considered. Furthermore, other scenarios can be created for other suspects that don't include John Byers. But the scars on Chris and John Byers' own words and behavior are sober testimony that keeps him well on top of the suspect list.
Of course it does. Yeah.
Moving on to the other Jason Baldwin. There are two Jason Baldwins whose names appear during the investigation, BT-dubs.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. There's a Shyamalama twist for you. From Detective Ridge's notes, quote, when asked about Jason Baldwin, he, Damien Eccles, described a Jason Baldwin that lived in West Memphis that was not his friend, Jason Baldwin. He claimed that the other was mean and that he had been known to kill snakes, which he claimed was just for the hell of killing. This Jason was described as being about 5'9" tall, 18 years old, and 300 pounds. Whoa. Sometimes it's difficult to determine whom was being referred to at any given moment. To prevent confusion here, each will be referred to by his full name. Their size is made for a striking contrast. Charles Jason Baldwin, arrested for the murders, was 5'8" and 112 pounds. Jason Howard Baldwin was also 5'8", but was described as close to 300 pounds. Oh, so that's what they meant by about 5'9".
Yeah.
I guess, so he's 5'8". Charles Jason Baldwin lived on Lakeshore in Marion, Arkansas. Jason Howard Baldwin lived in West Memphis in the victim's neighborhood on Johnson Street near where it intersected with Barton. Before being arrested for triple murder, Charles Jason Baldwin had a record of breaking into a garage where they had derelict cars and damaging those cars. He also had a separate arrest for shoplifting $6.38 worth of candy. Jason Howard Baldwin had been arrested in 1992 for possession of marijuana and fleeing a gasoline station without paying. Jason Howard Baldwin would go on to be arrested for aggravated robbery, theft of property, and robbery in West Memphis 1995, theft in Crittenden County in 1996, and theft and revocation of parole in 2005. So I think that's a little bit of a heftier charge than stealing $6 worth of candy.
Yeah, really.
But, you know, Jason Howard Baldwin's uncle, Louis Larry Baldwin III,
Louis Larry Baldwin III.
That is the most, like, snooty hick
right
name.
That's so weird.
So he was a sex offender who was brought in for questioning. He was on parole at the time for the aggravated rape of his two daughters.
Oh,
piece of shit. When asked about the evening of the 5th, he said he probably would have been at his home in Memphis. His family was in Texas at the time. He was brought in for a polygraph on July 2nd of 1993, a month after the arrests of the three. Detective Bill Durham affirmed, quote, "It is the opinion of this polygraph examiner that this subject recorded no significant responses which would have been indicative of deception." According to police notes, Baldwin was scheduled to take a polygraph on Friday, July 2nd, 1993 at 10 a.m. To clear up any suspicions of his involvement, the two Baldwins were confused one for the other in the police notes. Although in the above excerpt, Damien Eccles made clear he was referring to the big Jason Baldwin, the police notes on his questionnaire were ambiguous. In response to question 6, who Eccles believed may have committed the crimes, the answer read, quote, "Jason Baldwin could have, L.G. Hollingsworth." This document was then used by Baldwin's lawyer to argue for a severance, which I would too.
Yeah.
Because he's not saying that his friend did it. He's saying that this other Jason did, and possibly LG.
Yeah.
Ford stated in court, quote, "I would also like to mark as Defendant's Exhibit 4 a copy that was provided to me in discovery that is an interview that was conducted with the defendant Eccles. The first page is the questions they were asked, and the next pages reflect the answers that they gave. If you look at number 6, it said, 'Do you know who did this?' Turn to the next page, answer, 'Jason Baldwin could have, L.G. Hollingsworth.' It is my contention, Your Honor, that it is an out-of-court statement that implicates my client that entitles me to request a severance and requires the prosecutor to elect what his actions will be." This was then reported in and out of context by the media. Bartholomew Sullivan of the Commercial Appear wrote, 5 days after the murders of the three West Memphis boys last May, Damien Wayne Eccles told police that Jason Baldwin could have been involved."
Oh my God.
Leave it up to the fucking media.
Yep. Doesn't surprise me, honestly.
I want to keep the podcast focused on content that entertains, informs, and is mindful of your time. One way to accomplish this is direct listener support. Your support would help the show grow so much. So I've set up a link where you can quickly and easily support the show. The whole thing will take 30 seconds. It's glow.fm/somethingwicked. That's glow.fm/somethingwicked. We're asking for $3 a month, but you can contribute as much or as little as you'd like. If Something Wicked is part of your day or week and you love what we're doing, please visit glow.fm/somethingwicked and support us any way you can today. It's dead simple, and again, will take no more than 30 seconds. Click the link in the show notes, pay with Apple or Google Pay, and click the link of the podcast player that you want to use. You can listen anywhere at any time. Happy listening!
Bartholomew continued to say, "That revelation Wednesday by Charles Baldwin's attorney Paul N. Ford was introduced in an effort to gain a separate trial for Baldwin, who is secluded to stand trial with Eccles for capital murder February 22nd in Jonesboro." But Deputy Prosecuting Attorney John N. Fogelman said police officers' notes taken during the interview indicate Eccles was referring to another Jason Baldwin, someone who weighs 280 pounds and not Ford's diminutive 16-year-old client. In another story, the Commercial Appeal, reporter Mark Perisquia did not make the distinction. Then on Wednesday, at the hearing, Baldwin attorney Paul N. Ford revealed L.G. Hollingsworth's name while reading notes of a police interview with Eccles just days after the murders. According to the notes, Eccles told police two people could have been involved in the murders, Baldwin and Hollingsworth. The article in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette also did not make this distinction. They stated Baldwin's attorney, Paul N. Ford of West Memphis, argued at a pretrial hearing Wednesday that the two teenagers should be tried separately because Eccles told West Memphis police on May 10, 1993, that Baldwin could have killed 3 8-year-old West Memphis boys 5 days earlier. The two names being the same may have also confused those searching for the cult. Steve Jones, Charles Jason Baldwin's parole officer and the discoverer of the victims' bodies, wrote to the police of a conversation he had with Garrett Schwarting. Which, that's even confused, because some people are saying that Steve Jones discovered them. Another person is saying that a different officer discovered the boy. Yeah.
God. Nobody can seem to get their facts straight.
Mm-hmm. Garrett Schwarting also talked about Nerens belonging to a cult where they were sacrificing cats, and that Jesse Miss Kelly and Jason Baldwin were also members in this group.
Oh my God.
However, Jerry Nerens was a friend of Jason and Howard Baldwin. Jason Baldwin, 18 to 19, friend, lived on Johnson. Nerens made 19 notes from Detective Rich. In contrast, the notes from Gitchell's notes regarding Nerens merely mentions Jason Baldwin and does not distinguish between the two. Nerens was considered a significant suspect and was among seven included in a photo lineup shown to a child friend of the victims, probably Aaron.
Yeah, probably.
On June 2nd, 1993, a photo spread was formed from a few of the pictures that had been taken of possible suspects in this case that were to be shown to Aaron Hutchinson.
Yeah,
thank you. The photos consisted of seven white males that included Frankie Knight, Jerry Nerens, Murray Ferris, L.G. Hollingsworth, Tracy Laxton, James K. Martin, and Michael Leiter. The three who were arrested the next day were conspicuously absent. Also counted among Nerens' friends was Robert Birch. Robert Birch was familiar with both Jason Baldwins. However, according to his police notes, he was closer to Jason Howard Baldwin. Close friends see every day. Jason Baldwin, Johnson Street, not the one who lives on Lakeshore, from Detective Allen's notes. Birch was also arrested with Jason Howard Baldwin for stealing gasoline and possession of marijuana. In spite of a central place to many key characters in the investigation, the only note in the police file of Jason Howard Baldwin was his arrest report. Robert Birch, along with Jason Baldwin, were identified by Victoria Hutchinson as being members of the cult. She testified as to having visited a cult meeting, it should be noted. She later recanted this testimony and in general has given several different versions of the events. She made these comments about Jason Baldwin in her May 28, 1993 interview. Ridge asked Vicky, "The one you call Jason, how old is he?" She answered, "Probably 15. And when she asked her how tall he was, she said she had never seen him.
What?
Yeah.
Huh?
She thinks he's 15, but she can't. She's not sure because she's never seen him. But she knows who he is. Lady.
Yeah. This fucking lady.
And Alvis Bly claimed to have been a member of the cult. From the transcript of his June 29th, 1993 interview with Detective Mike Allen, Allen states, quote, "Name some of the people that participated in this," to which Bly responded, "I can't remember for 1 minute to the other inaudible. I would say it was Jason Inaudible Baldwin, then Miss Kelly." So it is actually written inaudible, and it could be significant. Because Jason Howard Baldwin did have a name between Jason and Baldwin, while Charles Jason Baldwin did not.
Yeah.
So the one that got charged was Charles Jason Baldwin, but everybody just called him Jason. Further complicating Bly's statement is his difficulty in remembering and sorting out names, along with a torturous and ambiguous identification of Baldwin. I present a long, not stupid long, I promise, section of this interview below for your interpretation. It seems as though he never identifies Baldwin by his photo, as evidenced by his repeatedly being asked to do this. There could be several possible reasons for that. One is his obvious confusion with the names. Another could be the Baldwin he knew was not among the photos. So it goes as follows. Detective Allen, okay, anyone else? You said Baldwin. Bly answers, yes, sir. They call him Davian.
Davian.
Yeah. They called who Damien? Baldwin. Okay, they called Baldwin Damien. I'm pretty sure it was him. Okay, let me, I've got a newspaper here. Yes, sir. It's got Jesse Miss Kelly. Yes, sir. And Jason Baldwin's picture here? Okay, is this the one they called Damien? No, sir. I'm pointing to Jason Baldwin. I see, that's not Davian. The other boy was Davian. I don't see him on the, there he is, that's Davian there. Okay, that's the one they called Damien there. Yes, sir. So Detective Allen says Davian, whatever you know him as. And Bly answered, Davian, that's the devil's name. So Allen goes, okay, and this is the person you know as Baldwin. Yes, sir. Point to a picture of Jason Baldwin and this person here. Do you recognize him? He's the leader. Miss Kelly is. Okay, all I know is Jason or Jess or Jesse, something like that. So he's basically...
There's nothing.
There's nothing there because Bly is calling a kid Davian.
Yeah.
And the detective is like, you mean Damien? You mean Damien? No, I think he knows what the fuck he said. So he, again, it's pushing. It's coercion.
Oh, yeah. No, the whole thing. And it's fucking useless because he's mixing people up too.
Yeah.
Like the whole fucking thing's useless.
So Jesse Miskelly Jr. began his interview with the police by stating that he had heard that Damien Eccles and Robert Birch had killed the children. Hours later, he confessed to his part in the murders, also naming Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin. But again, we know this is coerced, like I just fucking said.
Yeah.
So is it possible that Ms. Kelly was also referring to Jason Howard Baldwin? Although in interviews with others, the police took explicit steps to distinguish between the two. Bullshit. In Ms. Kelly's case, there was no such clarification. This possibility does not mean Ms. Kelly gave a true confession, only that in the statement he gave when he said Jason Baldwin, he was referring to Jason Howard Baldwin. Certainly, the larger Jason Howard Baldwin strikes a more formidable image of someone who could contain three children during a murder spree. Yeah, his picture's not pretty.
Yeah.
Like, no. Ms. Kelly's confession had Jason Baldwin as the more violent of the perpetrators. Baldwin was said to be the only one with the knife. Why then wouldn't Ms. Kelly simply clear this matter up? Having said he made a false confession, it would have been a complex matter to say, I made it up, but I made it up about someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, moving on to Terry Hobbs, Stevie's stepfather. I aim to break down every nook and cranny of this dumpster fire, so I'm sorry if I repeat some things, but I'm just trying to go into detail of each part. I'm going to cover the basis of it, then analyze. So here we go with this one. A documentary film about the 1993 killings west of Memphis, a film paid for and produced by well-known director Peter Jackson, suggests, without making direct accusation, that Terry Hobbs, stepfather of victim Stevie Branch, participated in the murders of the three boys. The filmmakers note that the most significant piece of DNA evidence was found at the crime scene. DNA and a hair found in one of the shoelaces used to tie up the boys matched the DNA of Terry Hobbs, as well as 1.5% of the population. So it's, again, speculation.
Right.
A second hair found on a tree stump near where the bodies were found matched that of David Jacoby, a friend of Terry Hobbs.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Sorry. I'll get into that. Whom Hobbs visited roughly an hour before the boys disappeared. They also questioned the alibi given by Hobbs that he spent the evening of the murders with his friend David Jacoby. In the film, Jacoby doubts whether he spent as much time with Hobbs that night as Hobbs suggests. The filmmakers also stress that Terry Hobbs had a long history of abuse, including an admitted assault on his wife and accusations of child beating and assaults on neighbors.
Wow.
An aunt of Stevie Branch, Judy Sadler, accuses Hobbs in the film of forcing his young son to watch him masturbate and of sexually molesting Stevie's sister, Amanda. Amanda, incidentally, says she cannot recall any sexual abuse by her stepfather.
I mean, in those situations, you tend to not.
They also managed to find a neighbor who claimed to have seen Hobbs with the three boys on the night of the murder, something Hobbs strongly denied. To this mix of circumstantial evidence, the filmmakers add the fact that another of Stevie's aunts, Jo Lynn McAfee, alleges she saw Terry Hobbs doing laundry the night of the murders, presumably to clean the mud off his clothes after killing the boys in the woods, and the fact that a prized pocket knife owned by Stevie, one he always carried with him, was later found among Terry Hobbs' possessions. Finally, and perhaps most damningly, the filmmakers produced three young men who now claim to have been told by a nephew of Terry Hobbs that the fact that Terry killed the three boys was a closely guarded family secret. In statements under oath, the three witnesses say that Michael Hobbs told them, "My uncle killed three boys in West Memphis." John Mark Byers, a stepfather of Chris Byers and initially the subject of a considerable suspicion himself, is shown calling Terry Hobbs a baby killer outside an Arkansas courtroom. He actually did.
Oh my god. Wait, was that the interview that we were watching or was that something else?
No, it was in the other one. So the ones that I know you didn't see West of Memphis. I know you saw the Paradise Lost trilogy.
Right.
But it's in the West of Memphis documentary where they're standing outside the courtroom bringing Terry in. And the reporters are going after John Mark Byers, you know, saying, like, what do you think of all the suspicions against you? And he straight out was like, I don't know why the hell you're interviewing me. You need to go after that baby killer that's walking through those doors right now.
Yeah.
Terry Hobbs, however, was not without his defenders. Todd Moore, a father of victim Michael Moore, found the evidence against Hobbs unpersuasive. He noted that his son spent a lot of time in the home of Terry Hobbs and could easily have picked up the hair with DNA matching that of Terry Hobbs found in his shoelaces on one of those occasions. Todd Moore asserted, quote, Terry Hobbs did not murder my son. No credible law enforcement officials believe so. Other critics of the Hobbs as the murderer theory noted that the statements by three young men 2 decades after the crime about the Hobbs family secret are 3 or 4 times removed from any original source and are far less probative than the second-hand testimony of 2 witnesses, I heard Damien say, blah, 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 in the Eccles-Baldwin trial. Hamish McKenzie, writing in The Atlantic, was critical of the decision of filmmakers in West of Memphis to place the blame for the murders on Terry Hobbs, calling Jackson a self-appointed producer prosecutor and the charges made in the movie reckless. Of course, reckless doesn't mean wrong. In 2013, what seems likely to be close to the true story of the West Memphis murders finally emerged in separate affidavits signed by Billy Wayne Stewart and Benny Guy. The level of detail and overall plausibility of the stories told in the affidavits make it seem highly credible, even if they do come from an admitted drug dealer and a convicted felon.
Right.
On May 5th, 1993, according to both Stewart and Guy, Terry Hobbs, David Jacoby, and 2 teenagers from a local trailer park, L.G. Hollingsworth and Buddy Lucas, showed up at his West Memphis home looking to buy some pot, which Stewart provided. While Stewart sold the 2 boys the pot, he noticed Hobbs and Jacoby kissing in a pickup truck across the street.
That's
my comment of him being a friend.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, according to Stewart, Hobbs was bisexual with a preference for sex with young boys. Hobbs, he stated, had invited his own 10-year-old son, Bill Bill, to pool parties, invitations which Stewart insisted his son decline. He's like, yeah, no, gross. You're not going over to that man's house. He's fucking freaky.
Yeah.
Like, no. What happened after Stewart sold the pot on May 5th was told to Stewart by Buddy Lucas in April of 1995. Getting back in the pickup, Hobbs, Jacoby, and the 2 boys drove around town smoking pot and drinking whiskey before heading down a dirt road by the Blue Beacon Wood. At that point, according to Lucas's account, Terry Hobbs asked the 2 teenagers to get out and wrestle while he and Jacoby watched. While Lucas does not specifically say the wrestling soon turned into sexual activity involving him, L.G. Hollingsworth and the 2 men, Stewart has no doubt that this happened, asserting that the lowered head and shame evident on the boy's face as he told the story made it clear there was more going on between the boys and the men than what Buddy had just told me.
Ugh.
Yeah, like when he was saying, he's like, oh yeah, they made me wrestle and stuff. Like his eyes were to the ground and he was shuffling and
yeah.
Like, yeah, it was during this likely sexual activity that Chris Byers, Michael Moore, and Stevie Branch appeared on their bikes at the wrong place at the wrong time. Stewart says Lucas told him that Terry Hobbs screamed, "Get them, little fuckers," while Jacoby beat one of the kids. Hobbs ordered Buddy and LG to pull off his pants. According to Stewart affidavit, quote, Mr. Hobbs walked over to the boy that Mr. Jacoby had been beating and repeatedly bit the boy's penis and scrotum.
What the fuck?
Then cut the boy's genitals. Terry Hobbs then announced that 2 other boys had to be killed because of what they had seen, and Hobbs and Jacoby proceeded to do just that. The boys' clothes and bodies were gathered and dragged to the water and their bikes thrown into the bayou. According to Buddy, Terry did this because he said, quote, we gotta get rid of this. They can't be found, at least not yet. Shockingly, according to Stewart, when he tried to call the West Memphis police investigator Bill Sanders 4 times to tell him the story he had heard from Buddy Lucas, Sanders never even bothered to return his phone calls.
Wow.
Bill understood from his drug dealing world that Sanders refused to return Bill's calls because he was connected in some way to Terry Hobbs. Bill said that beyond that, due to his connections, he had knowledge that Terry had links to at least 2 other murders.
Oh my God.
He also tried to call his friend from the department, Paul Weaver, a state narcotics officer, to tell him what Buddy had said. Paul, in turn, said, quote, Billy, you're a well-known drug dealer. You've been busted before and probably will be busted again. I don't know if they will put any credit into what you're saying. And really, the only person I know that I got to go to with this is my boss. So Bill told him that was bullshit, that regardless of his past, this was serious and it didn't matter what happened to him. And Paul responded that regardless of what Bill said, the case was closed and they didn't want any further interference, that they didn't want to hear any different. If this allegation is true, and it certainly rings so, readers can debate whether that decision, which meant the continued incarceration of 3 almost certainly innocent young men for another 16 years of the murders in the Blue Beacon Wood, was the greater tragedy.
Yeah, seriously.
Benny Guy's affidavit tells a similar story. Guy stated that while Buddy, who Guy describes as pretty bad slow, which, okay.
Like special?
Yeah, I guess. Was staying in his home in 1994. He confessed his involvement in the killings. Terry was never formally interviewed by police until many years later. He has a background of being violent and having a temper. His ex-wife accused him of abusing and beating her, and he was seen with the boys that night by a neighbor. She saw Terry walking towards the three boys on the bikes and yelling at them to come home. Then she saw the boys going towards him. I haven't been able to find at what exact time this supposedly occurred. He was the only one of the parents that didn't have a definitive alibi, too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm.
He claimed that he spent the evening of the murders with David Jacoby, so instead of going out to look for his son, he went to his buddies to drink beer and play guitars.
And smoke weed. Nice.
He said he went over there initially to ask David for help, but ended up chilling before he was all, oh, Stevie's missing, I should probably go look for him. I think we should go look in the woods, so I'm gonna go home and change my clothes and get a flashlight and I'll pick you back up. Because Pam also stated that he was wearing different clothes when he picked her up from work as opposed to earlier in the day, so why though? Because according to Pam, it was he started where he was wearing, I think it was like jeans and a t-shirt, and then he changed into this purple tank top and shorts.
Weird.
Yeah, it's, yeah. But Terry never came back, and this is when everybody in town had gone out and searched for these boys in the woods, and Terry claims he was part of the search party. So he doesn't really have an alibi, and no one else that was searching even remembers him being there.
Yeah.
Terry didn't show up to pick up Pam from work until 9:30. That's when he used the restaurant's phone to call in the missing persons report, but he didn't tell Pam their son was missing. She found out from her daughter in the car while waiting for Terry to come back out.
Oh my God.
He showed up. She came out. She started coming out to get into the car, and he's like, I gotta use the phone, and then ran in the restaurant to call the police. And meanwhile, because Pam was like, where's Stevie?
Yeah.
And Amanda's sitting in the back and she's like, Stevie's missing. And she's like, what?
Yeah.
And then Terry got back in the car and she's like, what the hell? Why didn't you tell me? He's like, I had to call the police. She's like, why didn't you tell me before?
Yeah.
And then there's Stevie's knife that he got from his grandfather. He always had it on him.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't found at the crime scene. And in 2004, Pam found out that Terry had it hidden among his personal belongings. She later said that she always figured that the murderer had Stevie's knife. Pam stated that 2 weeks before he was murdered, Stevie told her to leave Terry. When she asked why, he said, quote, he loves Amanda, but he don't love me.
Oh.
So again, all these things. And yeah. It gets worse. Stevie was terrified of Terry. Amanda, Stevie's little sister, was terrified of him as well and was possibly molested by him. Good times. She is now an adult and completely fucked up mentally. She has been using drugs and says that she has no memory of her childhood, that there's all these blank spots, which, as you know, is a trauma response.
Yeah, really.
She herself even states that she thinks it's due to trauma and her brain is trying to block out bad memories. She can only remember things that she wrote in her journal from when she was younger, such as telling her mom that Terry would mess with her and that he would beat her with a belt so bad it would leave welts on her back.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I was crying watching this fucking interview. She was like losing her shit in the back of a car while the interviewer was talking to her.
Yeah.
And she was, you could see how much PTSD was kicking in. It's ridiculous. Additionally, one of Stevie's aunts said that the day he went missing, Terry came home and was cleaning Stevie's room and doing laundry, which she noted as odd because he was very much a housework is a woman's job guy, so he had never cleaned anything in the house before that night.
Yeah, that's super suspicious.
And the other aunt stated that Stevie had told her that Terry would come into his room at night, make Stevie watch him masturbate, and then developed into Terry forcing Stevie to start touching his four-year-old sister.
Oh my God.
So that's the more in-depth of that accusation.
That's fucking awful.
Ooh, deep breaths. I got this. Piece of shit.
Yeah.
Pam also stated that he would abuse her and Stevie. He would go after Stevie, making him hold his arms above his head while he whipped him with a belt, or lift him off the ground completely while he beat him by his hair.
Oh my God.
And this was all because he was mad at Pam for giving more attention to Stevie than to him, her husband. So he beat his stepson out of jealousy. Again, a piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Terry and Pam were having difficulties in their marriage prior to 1993. They had separated for a time. Shortly after the murders, the Hobbs retreated to Pam's family's home in Blytheville, Arkansas. 2 weeks after the murders, Terry left Pam to stay in Hardy, Arkansas, 120 miles from West Memphis. By doing this, Terry avoided being brought in for questioning by the police.
Of course it did.
From the beginning, Pam's family accused him of the murders. According to Terry Hobbs, his brother-in-law, Jackie Hicks Jr., had regularly threatened him for having killed Stevie. Their dispute came to a boil in November of 1994 when Terry struck Pamela and Pamela called her family for help. Terry loaded his .357 Magnum with hollow point bullets, and when Jackie Hicks Jr. began fighting with Terry, Terry shot him in the gut.
Oh my god.
He survived for 10 more years until he died from a clot release during a follow-up surgery. The Hicks blamed Hobbs for his death. I'm sorry, that right there should get him booked for anything if manslaughter or murder too.
I don't know how that would work, seeing as it was like 10 years.
It's the underlying cause.
Yeah,
the surgery happened because he got shot in the gut by Terry. That should be murder too, if anything. Like, okay. I said, or manslaughter, because that means, you know, it could be a he shot him out of anger. That's not planning to shoot him, so it's not murder one. It would be two, because it's spur of the moment.
Okay.
But he still died, in my opinion. I agree with the family, as a result of Terry shooting him, so he should be booked for that.
Yeah.
Terry Hobbs was arrested for drug possession in 2003. He was reported twice for abusing his daughter, Amanda. Pamela Hobbs took out a restraining order against him in 2005. They are divorced, and Terry's name was removed from his stepson's tombstone. Thank God.
Good.
And the last piece of past proof from him being an abusive, perverted asshole came from a woman named Mildred French. She knew and lived near Terry. He had broken into her house while she was taking a bath one night, so she shot up and was all, "What are you doing in my house?" And he tried to shush her and grabbed her breasts, so she screamed louder and he ran. The police were called, but he was never apprehended.
What the fuck?
Yeah, he later claimed in an interview that that never happened and she's making it all up. Of course he's fucking said that.
Yeah.
This interview was the one that was done due to him suing Natalie Maines of the Dixie Chicks, by the way, over a tweet saying that the police needed to look into him more. She never accused him, but that's how he took it, and he thought he was going to get millions of dollars for emotional harassment. Not surprising that didn't happen.
Yeah, really. Dumbass.
Oh my god. In 2013, the allegations from Benny Guy in the years after the murders, according to his affidavit, Benny, LG, and Buddy Lucas had at one point confessed to killing the boys alongside Terry Hobbs and David Jacoby. According to LG's confession, he was with Terry, Buddy, and David drinking and getting high in the woods when the boys surprised them as the sun started to set. Again, the sun set there at 7:45 p.m. He said it was Terry who told the others to get the boys, theoretically because he was angry that his stepson and his friends had seen them down there. That's when they were stripped, beaten, and dumped into the creek. Also in 2013, the attorney for Chris Byers' family filed affidavits accusing all four men of the murders, according to Arkansas Online. According to Benny Guy's affidavit from February 15, 2003, in accordance to LG's confession, he states that in July of 1995, he was arrested and detained in the Crittenden County Jail. He was placed in a two-man cell with a man he didn't initially recognize. After 4 or 5 days of being in that cell, his cellmate asked Benny if they thought they, the PD, could find out if someone had killed someone a long time ago. Could they find out who did it, like when the boys were killed? It then dawned on Benny that his cellmate was LG. He didn't recognize him at first because I guess LG had blown up.
Yeah.
So I get it. Benny told LG that Buddy had told him everything already. So LG initially denied it, but when he heard Buddy spilled, he told Benny exactly the same story that Buddy told Bill. He added things like, what made Terry snap was that the boy David caught kicked Terry, so Terry said, "I'll teach your little fucking ass," and then Terry and David beat all three of the boys. Then Terry made LG and Buddy hold down the boy who kicked him down and to spread his legs apart so he could cut his genitals. Benny said that LG had a look of pride on his face as he was telling him. LG said he was one of the first people to be questioned and that he failed his polygraph, but they let him go.
Oh my fucking god. We already knew that, but still.
The fact, it's just, the first biggest red flag to me was the fact that after he found out that the guy spilled, he told the same exact story.
Yeah.
If you are trying to say that you had nothing to do with it, and you don't know, you have no associations with these other people, how the fuck do you have the same story?
Exactly.
And the fact that he smiled while telling him this.
That's fucking gross.
And that he said he got a polygraph, failed it, and the police were like, nah, you're good. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Benny immediately told Crittenden County CI Ed Laxton, but Benny never heard back from him. On February 12, 2012, Benny wrote a letter to prosecutor Scott Ellington about what happened with the crime and stressed his desire to speak with him concerning these facts because he felt it was important for the truth to be known, and Scott never responded to his request.
Of course not.
At the time of the killings, Buddy Lucas was a 19-year-old friend of Jesse. He was even mentioned in Jesse's confession on June 3rd of 1993 as a friend of his who borrowed the shoes he said he was wearing on May 5th. Over the next few months, Buddy was questioned periodically, and eventually he implicated Jesse, Jason, and Damian. Back then, David Jacoby knew Terry through his wife, Pam. When he asked her how his hair might have ended up at the crime scene, he pointed out that he and Terry had searched for the boys there that night. He also denies any allegations that he had anything to do with the murders. Of course he fucking did.
Yeah.
The FBI profiler John Douglas actually put a profile together on the killer, and he suggested the killer knew all three boys well, which explains why their bodies were pinned down with sticks and their clothes and bikes were hidden as well. The killer needed time to establish his alibi, and the kids couldn't be found too quickly. So what was the potential motive? Punishment.
Yeah.
And I stated this in part one.
Yeah.
And this, the fact that somebody is saying that Terry was like, they can't be found, at least not yet.
Yeah. Exactly.
Come on. And when things got out of hand, all three boys were killed to keep them quiet. He also said that the way they were killed says a lot about who did it and why. For example, if it had been premeditated, ritualistic sacrifice by the three teens, wouldn't they have brought weapons and ligatures to the scene?
Right.
But the kids were killed and bound with things that were on hand at the time, sticks, boards, and their own shoelaces. Part of the FBI's profile points to a person with a background as a butcher or hunter due to the hog tying. He may also have a history of domestic violence, and only one person checks all of those boxes, Terry Hobbs. But despite the many accusations leveled against him over the years, he always maintained his innocence and insists the police got the right killers the first time. At this point in time, most of the parents have maintained their side in the belief that the WM3 are innocent. So, for a little snippet background on Terry, aside from the abuse and violence charges, because again, why I said he checks all the boxes.
Yeah.
Terry Hobbs was born in 1958 in northern Arkansas, one of four children, son of Edith Raylan McLeod Hobbs and Joe Dean Hobbs Sr. Hobbs Sr. learned his trade as a butcher while in the military and went on to open 30 restaurants.
Wow.
He was also a minister in the Apostolic Pentecost Church, a fundamentalist group. Terry Hobbs claimed to have seen evil spirits cast out. His upbringing was strict. The family faith did not allow television at home or participation in sports. And along with his brothers, he was expected to work in the slaughterhouse butchering pigs and cattle. Check, check, check.
Yeah.
Going into the final part of the breakdown, the friend who heard about the family secret, Blake Sisk, a friend of Michael Hobbs Jr., Terry's nephew. So Michael Jr. lives in a town called Mountain Home, Arkansas. His dad, Michael Hobbs Sr., runs a restaurant there called Reel 'Em In Catfish, and they lived there a long time. First thing that Blake told interviewers was that when he and Michael Jr. were 12 or 13, they had been playing football in the yard at Jr.'s house, and when they were done playing, they came into the house, got a drink, and were going to go down to the basement to play pool. Blake says, quote, Michael said that his uncle and dad were in the downstairs basement, and we were going to go downstairs, but his dad hollered, don't come down here, we're busy talking, so me and Michael decided to listen in. Michael Jr. told the witness that his dad was down there with his uncle, sounded like he, his uncle, might have been crying, saying, I'm sorry for what happened and I regret it. Blake says Michael's dad was just consoling him about the situation and everything would be all right, saying you're not in any trouble. A number of years later, Blake and a friend were picked up by Michael Jr. in Jr.'s truck. Cody Gott, the friend, said, quote, when he picked us up, it was like he wasn't even the same Michael. He wasn't in the same mood that he usually is. He's usually outgoing, like ready to go do something, ready to talk, and he was just real quiet. Blake backs up that statement, also saying Michael wasn't as talkative and asked him what was going on. Cody continued saying, I was like, what's up, man? And he said he told me that my Uncle Terry, he killed those kids in that case, in the West Memphis 3 case. Blake continued saying, and then he was like, well, my dad told me that my uncle's the one who murdered those three kids, and it's been, you know, on my mind all day. It's just been running through my head, and I was just in shock. I didn't really know what to say. End quote. Then Cody stated, according to Michael Jr., his dad called this the Hobbs family secret. Blake continued on saying, he said, only me and my dad, my uncle, and I think maybe his mom and someone else in the family might have knew, but it might have been his older brother. He just called it the Hobbs family secret. And he said, if they knew I told you, I would be in deep crap. End quote.
Oh, wow.
Mm. There was a third friend that they thought might also have some information. And what this third witness told the interviewer when he came was, quote, Michael Hobbs Jr. and I and a third friend were playing pool in the basement. During the course of the game, the third friend said something about the WM3 case. Then this third witness asked, what's the WM3 case? And Michael Jr. responded to him saying, my uncle killed three kids in West Memphis. And according to this third witness, Michael Jr. was dead serious when he said this. In addition to getting them to sign declarations under penalty of perjury, they all took polygraphs. They all passed, with the tester concluding that they were absolutely telling the truth about what they heard Michael Jr. say.
Wow.
So we have several people,
yeah,
all saying that Terry himself stated that he did it. Unfortunately for the courts, it's hearsay. I can't stress enough how much of a reason, based on the witness statements, how similar they are, from the evidence found that was never fully looked into, from the lack of follow-ups or interviews on what seems like only on Terry, the fact that the first time he was ever interviewed about any of this was only after he lost the case against Natalie from the Dixie Chicks, this, in my mind, points directly at Terry. Besides the obvious reasons of persecution prejudice being things like satanic panic, Vicki Hutchinson playing detective, Jesse's confession under duress, the entire crime scene debacle of not securing it properly, the bodies were moved and left out in the sun for 2.5 hours, insufficient notes were taken, the luminol tests weren't done until 6 days later, and the big one of the DNA evidence not linking any of the three teens to the scene, but linking both Terry and David to it. Unfortunately, the WMPD are not willing to entertain any of these theories or admit to their errors. Todd Moore, the father of victim Michael Moore, prosecutor John Fogelman, most detectives involved in the case, and many others continue to contend that the murders were committed by Jesse Miss Kelly, Jason Baldwin, and Damien Eccles. They begin by pointing out that two juries in 1994, after listening to all the evidence, found three guilty. They neglect to point out, however, that much of the most potentially persuasive evidence that defense attorneys hoped to introduce in those trials were excluded by Judge Burnett. They argue that Jesse Miss Kelly confessed no less than 5 times to the killings after his arrest and in the year following the trials. They note that Damien Eccles had a long history of mental health problems before the murders and described himself at one point as homicidal, suicidal, and schizophrenic. They also contended that the fact that the three different knots were used to hogtie the young victims points to the involvement of three killers, not one or two. And of course, they believe that much of the evidence produced in the Eccles-Baldwin trial was quite probative, including the testimony of 2 12-year-old girls who say they heard Damien confess to the murders at a softball park, and blue candle wax was found on Chris Byers' shirt that was consistent with candle wax found in the bedroom of Eccles. Others who continue to believe in the guilt of the West Memphis Three point to an interview given to police on May 18, 1993 by Laura Maxwell, another third-hand story admittedly, in which she was told by a friend that Damien killed the boys after they saw something they weren't supposed to have seen, presumably Eccles, Baldwin, and Miss Kelly engaged in devil-worshipping meetings in the park. After the filing of the Stewart affidavit in 2013, it remains to be seen whether those who have long maintained that West Memphis 3 were guilty as charged will continue to do so. My biggest aggravation in all of this, again, is the fact that regardless of the evidence, regardless of the witness statements, or anything revolved in this case, no one seems to give a shit.
No.
About finding who really did it to bring justice for these boys.
No, they just want to fucking point fingers and close the case.
And I really, really hope that one day it gets solved. Whoever did it. I don't give a shit. I just want those boys to be at peace.
Yeah. And their families.
Yeah. I really hope that happens.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. Tune in next time for more ghastly ghouls and crazy killers. Don't forget to follow us on Anchor, give us some love on Glow, follow the links in the show notes to get your merch, and hop on over to our Facebook group for updates on upcoming episodes. Laters!